Chapter 16. Farah of House Leywurin lobbed a fireball over the edge of Highwatch's ramparts. It fell until it was nothing but a glowing speck. A moment later, its descent was punctuated with a distant flash and rumble. The Solomancer nodded in satisfaction.
"You're not to attack yet,"
said Jeddak. The burly dwarf glared up at the elf. Farah snorted.
"Tell that to whoever cast the massive light spell," she said. "They took at least a quarter of the kills in one shot, and they weren't even the first to fire."
"They won't get points for the kills," said Jeddak. "The guild shan't reward those who ignore the contracts."
"Oh, look around you. Everyone's ignoring the contracts."
Farah waved her arm across the fortress. Along the eastern ramparts, professional heroes wove spells, tossed exploding vials of phosphorescent liquid, slung enchanted stones, loosed arrows, and in one instance fired blasts of glittering dust from an elaborate gnomish steam cannon.
"Even the Silverfire Six are attacking."
Farah pointed to the famous crew, already weaving another fireball in her offhand.
"Besides, it's only a matter of time before they fire up those big orbs and annihilate the whole undead army."
She nodded at the luminous sphere a short way up the rampart. Strange Umbraxian workers scuttled around its base, clad in their body-length coats and crimson goggles.
"And nobody gets the points for all those kills."
"'Tisn't right," said Jeddak. "The contract says we're to go in order."
"The contracts are for the lawyers to sort out," Farah said, hurling the fireball over the rampart. "At the end of the day, there are going to be two groups of heroes walking out of Highwatch. Those who got enough kills to earn some points or a spot of loot, and those who forgot to bring a ranged weapon."
Jeddak only snorted and turned back to the battlefield, his warhammer slung impotently over his shoulder.
"'Tisn't right."
"A travesty,"
Farah murmured, looking over the ramparts.
"How many do you suppose I hit with that last fireball?"
"What's that dancing light?"
Jeddak asked.
"A flaming zombie, I think," said Farah, squinting down at the crater left by her spell. "Must have been close to the blast."
"'Tisn't a zombie," said Jeddak.
"A ghoul, maybe? But look at the way it staggers. Well, who can say from this distance? It looks like a drunken firefly from up here."
"I'm talking about that glow in the sky," said Jeddak, pointing.
Farah looked up and saw a faint purple spark rising toward the clouds. Just short of its zenith, the spark burst into a starburst of amethyst light. The heroes on the ramparts ducked behind the wall, but the expected blast of sorcerous nastiness never reached them. When Farah peeked over the edge of the fortification, she saw strange writing emblazoned in glowing violet trails across the sky. They read, "Yutani Arm Traders."
"Is that some kind of advertisement?"
asked Jeddak. Farah felt a sinking feeling in her gut. She turned to stare at the great glowing orbs being set up across the ramparts.
"Isn't that the Umbraxian company that built the—"
"Look, they're moving,"
Jeddak interrupted. The letters slid around in the sky like tiles from a gnomish printing press. The blood froze in Farah's veins as they found their final place. "It's Datar Ermion."
"Bones,"
swore Jeddak. It looked like he was saying something else, but his voice was drowned out by the screams erupting around the ramparts. The Umbraxian attendants around the great orbs had thrown aside their long coats, revealing rotten, pitted torsos. Azure flames sprang from their hands, setting the bannermen about them alight.
"Revenants," gasped Farah.
Jeddak brushed past her, charging toward the cackling undead. Farah followed him, already readying a spell. Ahead of them, other heroes rushed toward the orbs to mount a counteroffensive against the revenants. A golden spear impaled one abomination, and a Noctomancer's lightning reduced another to a twitching mass of charred flesh. Farah wondered if there would be any left to kill by the time she reached the base of the glowing green orb. Then she heard the crack. The wretched sound rent the air, leaving a high-pitched whine at the corner of hearing. Then there was another crack, and then a snap, and she could see deep fissures winding up the side of the great emerald orb.
"Run!"
Farah yelled amid a chorus of similar warnings, but they were all too late. The orb exploded in a tide of vile, viscous fluid. The cries of the heroes and bannermen closest to the epicenter cut off as the green wave rolled over them. Farah watched the entire Silverfire Six fall under the noxious wave in an instant.
Moments later, their oozing remains stood back up and shambled toward the survivors. Farah turned and fled. Behind her, the ooze was creeping along with sinister purpose, winding its way along the ramparts in a grim river. Any bannerman or hero caught in the viscous mass was sucked under the surface, only to emerge as another undead soldier trying to pull the living into the slime. The remaining defenders pushed each other out of the way to flee. Farah turned her attention to retreat, and then stopped short. Ahead of her, another orb had already completed its grim task. Her path was blocked by a horde of shambling corpses and a chartreuse pool of bubbling death. There was no escape. The Solomancer grit her teeth and began to weave a fireball. I'll just have to fight my way. The words were knocked from her, along with the rest of her breath, as something heavy slammed into her ribcage. She stumbled and turned to see Jeddak looming over her. The remnants of the dwarf's black beard barely clung to his green and shriveled flesh, but his gaunt frame was imbued with a supernatural strength. The second swing of his warhammer swept her over the edge of the ramparts and into oblivion.
An anagram. Jin was stone-faced as he stared at the glowing letters in the sky over the battlefield. The big reveal of your master plan was an anagram.
Gorm and the other combatants stared at the message in the air above Highwatch. Screams rang out along the ramparts.
Perhaps the wordplay was a little indulgent, conceded Datar, but I needed a good line to ensure the living will grasp the full scope of my plans.
It's just so vulgar, spat Jin. People are dying, and you're worried about how it looks.
I take pride in my work, said the Lich, and there's nothing wrong with a good quip. They say you're allowed to make one.
Are you serious? Jin hurled a spell at his father. It's a maladroit, tacky joke punctuating a travesty.
Tacky?
The Lich made a rapid series of precise gestures, and an intricate web of darkness and stone sprang up from the plateau to intercept the spell. How dare you?
You have the subtlety of a warhammer, shouted the Noctomancer. You always do everything so garishly over the top. Even those overcomplicated wards you're weaving are just meant to impress us.
As usual, you are mistaken, boy.
Datar shrugged and flexed his fingers, sending the glowing wards around him into an intricate dance.
I might have strong aesthetic sensibilities, but there's always a purpose to my work. These weaves are a perfect example. They weren't for your benefit.
Jin shook his head.
Then who?
Why not ask the Solomancer?
The skeletal wizard nodded to Laruna. Gorm and the other heroes turned to look at the mage. The Solomancer leaned back as though wrestling an invisible opponent. Her face and knuckles blanched as she gripped the wormwood staff.
I can't, she wheezed, her voice strained to the breaking point. Jin, I can't!
You can't what, girl? Mused Datar as his son rushed to the mage. Fight? Weave? Or even hang on. It looks like that staff you're holding is proving uncooperative. Gorm swore under his breath, but then he realized that all eyes were on the Solomancer. It was as close to a chance as the Berserker would ever have. He charged, rapidly closing the distance between himself and the distracted Lich. A shard of stone erupted from the rock in front of him, catching his shoulder. Another ripped through the spot where he landed, forcing him to pivot awkwardly into the path of a third lance of stone. Cursing, the dwarf scrambled back in retreat. The Lich turned and caught his eye, and Gorm felt his stomach drop. The window of opportunity to attack the Lich was gone. It had never really been an opportunity at all.
Come on, Jin said, rushing to Laruna's side. You can do this.
Can't hold it, gasped Laruna. It doesn't want to be used,
Laruna groaned.
Close, glee was evident in Datar's voice. It doesn't want you to use it.
And this is why you never trust a sentient weapon, said Heraldin.
Not helping, hissed Laruna. I'll concede that you have power, Solomancer.
Datar rose higher, weaves of Noctomancy spiraling around him in complex patterns. He thrust his arms out, and the lightning and stone coalesced around him into a pair of sinister wings, bat-like spindles of bone webbed with crackling green lightning. But I have power as well, and beyond that, I have mastery.
No! Shrieked Laruna, stumbling as the relic lurched in her hands.
Come, staff! Called Datar, raising a skeletal hand into the air. I am the master of the Crown of Iron Thorns, the commander of the Host of the Dead. No living mage is as worthy of your service as I.
Jin gripped the weapon with Laruna, and Gaste leaped into the fray to grab hold of the shaft. It wasn't enough. The wormwood staff wrenched itself free of the hero's collective grasp and floated through the air into Datar's waiting hand. The crystal at its top flared with violet light as the lich's bony fingers wrapped around the grip. Swirling winds suddenly rushed around the plateau. Blinding viridian and amethyst light surrounded the lich, and lightning spiderwebbed across the black sky.
Beyond the undead wizard, Gorm could see an unholy green glow rising from the ramparts of Highwatch. Sporadic explosions of incandescent ooze sent plumes of foul vapor into the sky above the fortress.
Haraldin wrapped the dwarf on his shoulder as he sprinted past. Run, you fools! The bard shouted. Live to run another day!
Jin and Gaste turned to flee, carrying Laruna between them. Patches whimpered and bolted away. Gorm didn't bother moving as the lich wove a final spell.
Too late, he muttered to himself.
Thank you all for the staff, called Datar from the center of the maelstrom. I must be off to cement my victory at Highwatch. But don't think of it as goodbye. It's more of a see you soon.
The lich dipped the wormwood staff, and a red light fell from the crystal at its tip. The glow trailed downward in a slow, meandering descent, like an autumn leaf.
Because I'll be bringing you all back as the undead after the battle, in case that wasn't clear, added Datar.
Oh, by the gods, father!
Jin stopped at the edge of the plateau. It isn't witty if you have to explain—
A thunderclap loosed as the crimson light touched the mountain, sending a blast of dust and molten stone flying in a wide radius. Gorm was blown into the air like debris in a hurricane. The edge of the cliff passed beneath him, and he and his companions fell screaming down the mountain.
General Gergen screamed something at the bannermen, but the chaos below drowned out her words. King Handor gazed down with dull eyes into the swirling nightmare, watching the tide of ooze rise over the remnants of his army. Highwatch was a sea of glowing green, punctuated by flashes of orange and red flames.
All of our greatest heroes, the king muttered to ashes blowing in the wind. The army of the greatest nation on Arth. Gone. All gone.
With the defenders of Highwatch in shambles, the undead outside the wall were free to advance at will. Spectral ghosts, dark wraiths in flowing robes, and keening banshees flew over the fortifications to attack the survivors in the inner courtyard. The dead heroes and bannermen from the ramparts turned their bows and slings upon the living. An arrow bounced off the stone at Handor's feet. He stared at it impassively.
My kingdom.
Everything, he said, staring bleary-eyed at the scene below him.
Doomed.
A mailed hand grabbed the king's shoulder and pulled him back from the edge of the keep. To the eagles, Majesty! General Gergen roared in his ear as she shoved him toward the waiting birds. The eagles! Handor stumbled toward the massive raptor, dancing nervously at the center of the keep. It occurred to him that Goldson, Bags, and their eagle had already departed. Weaver Ortson and Dennel Clubs rose into the sky on their own bird, gliding in lazy circles above the burning fortress. The king watched them ascend as he allowed a bannerman to help him mount. A moment later, he felt his seat shift as Johann leapt into the saddle behind him.
Ho! Upward! Cried the paladin.
The eagle hopped to the edge of the keep and launched into the sky, rising into the dark sky on currents of hot air.
Gone, the king moaned, tears beating at the edges of his eyes.
Now ghouls and skeletons were clamoring over Highwatch's walls. Pockets of resisting heroes and soldiers fled for the tunnels beneath Highwatch.
The banners of the army of the Freedlands lay scattered through the courtyard. It's all gone. The races of man will join the kingdom of death. All is hopeless.
It is a setback, sire, yelled Johann, but where most men see challenges, great men see opportunities, right? Ha!
Opportunity? Confusion catalyzed Handor's grief into rage.
How could there be any thrice cursed opportunity in this? The army is gone. Our heroes are gone. My kingdom is defenseless, and I was party to the thrice cursed scheme that led to this disaster.
A major setback, sire, said the champion of Tandos. But surely you can come back.
It is more than a setback,
moaned Handor, looking down at the carnage as the eagle's circuitous ascent brought them over Highwatch once more.
It is the beginning of the end. There is nothing left for me now but to confess my sins and abdicate the throne.
Johann was silent for a moment. Then Handor felt a mailed hand rest on his shoulder.
You haven't failed entirely, sire. On the contrary, you've been most useful, said the paladin.
Something in the champion's voice stirred Handor from his stupor.
What do you mean by that?
And there is still a way for you to serve the kingdom. Johann ignored the king. The warrior's grip was getting firmer. Handor tried to pull away.
Johann, what are you—
The paladin's left arm wrapped around Handor, and sudden pain flared in the king's chest. He looked down to see an arrow, still clasped in Johann's fist, protruding from a dark stain that was spreading across his royal robes.
Martyrdom, the paladin said in Handor's ear.
The king tried to speak, but there was no air in his lungs.
Ha! Goodbye, old friend!
The champion of Tandos began to loosen the dying man's straps. Questions filled the king's mind as his assailant worked, but they all fled his consciousness as Johann gave him a shove. Handor tumbled through the air, looking back at his murderer. Johann was leaning over the edge of the saddle, screaming something he couldn't make out. The paladin's arm was reaching in a pantomimed effort to save the king, but behind the outstretched hand, Johann was still smiling. It was all an act, of course. It had always been an act. The wind flipped him over, and the king could see the sea of ooze and flame rushing toward him. Silently screaming, Handor plummeted into a storm of fire and death.
Didn't see that coming? Heh!
Ignatius allowed himself a small giggle as he watched the lights flash in the eyes of the shrine of Mordo Og. One particular glow lingered longer than normal before fading away.
Must have been a big one. Always interesting when the important ones go.
The light quickly resumed its rapid flickering, blinking on and off at a pace indicative of huge battles, natural disasters, or large cults attempting to reach the gods by sharing a barrel of fermented hemlock. In a way, such cultists succeeded. Everyone involved encountered Ignatius's god at the minimum. Normally, such deadly events were an amusing interlude for a servant of Mordo Og, but Ignatius' glee was muted. At the end of every crimson pulse of light came an equally emphatic green pulse. The old priest grimaced.
They're getting up. All the dead are getting up again.
Ignatius scowled and drew his cloak around himself as if to ward off a chill.
Dark times are ahead.
Gorm's world was darkness and agony. Every part of him felt like it was on fire, and given the charred smell in his nostrils, he very well might have been. Somewhere on the edge of searing pain, he felt something wet. The wetness was new. His brow knotted as he concentrated on the sensation. It wasn't like the persistent dampness around his shredded broken limbs or the warmth of the blood leaking from the slash across his chest. Instead, it was a moist, rhythmic slathering, gently pulsing up his cheek toward his... Gorm sputtered and choked as a dog tongue slid into his open mouth.
Good find, Patches, said Bert's voice, approaching from a distance. Now down! Stop kissing the dwarf! No! Stop kissing... don't kiss me, neither! No! Down!
There was a brief scuffle in the gravel, and then tiny paws stepped up next to his head. Gorm heard the glassy pop of a cork being removed from a vial, and a moment later he felt the bottle pressed to his lips. A familiar coppery taste filled his mouth and seared down his throat, a comforting warmth spreading through him in its wake. He felt ribs mending, wounds closing, broken bones stitching themselves back together. He grunted as his shoulder popped back into place and muscle spasms dragged his shattered legs back into the proper alignment. They fused back together with a sudden snap. Gorm choked on a gulp of air and opened his eyes.
"Morning, sunshine," said Bert, leaning over him.
A high cliff loomed behind the kobold, and above the mountain, the sky was warming with the dawn's first light.
"Feeling better?"
"The others?"
Gorm croaked.
"Same as you," said Bert. "Scattered across the mountainside and banged up, but Patches sniffed them all out, and none of them had wounds a vial or two of salve wouldn't fix. Good thing old Bert had the sense to grab your rucksack and make a break for it."
"I thank you,"
a thought struck Gorm.
"Wait, you can carry me rucksack?" "Well, I had to dump a few non-essentials. To maintain speed, you know."
Gorm eyed the kobold warily.
"Non-essentials such as everything that wasn't either salve, edible, or mine. What of Niln's book?" "Yes, I brought your precious book, heavy as it was. Look, the point is, the kobold saved you all,"
said Bert.
"I thank you, Bert."
Gorm sat up and tried to make sense of the world. The Lich's victory, the fate of High Watch, where to go from here. And then there was another question.
"What's with the pig?"
Bert glanced back at the dead hog sitting in the branches of a gnarled tree.
"It was there when we found you."
"Strange,"
said Gorm.
"That's par for the course, I'd say," said the kobold. "Weird things show up all the time around you. At least this one's edible."
Gorm stared at the pig. It had one eye. "Assuming we can get it down from there."
"I'm sure you'll find a way."
The kobold gave him a pat on the knee.
"Come on, Laroon has found the horses, and the others are waiting."
"What's keeping them?"
Dwen Poldo asked, sitting at the small conference table he kept in his new home office.
"Well, the permits, for one," said Mrs. Herc, glancing at her clipboard. "You've owned the building for less than a week, and the city already granted us several exceptions. The clerk said things don't usually move this fast."
"It's hardly fast enough. No, let me,"
he added, lifting the teapot before Mrs. Herc could take it from him. He filled his own mug and then topped off the Knolls as well.
"We can't keep up with demand. How many tenants do we have now?"
"Oh, well over 4 dozen, said Mrs. Herc, reluctantly accepting her tea. "And that's just the Shadowkin. We also have an ogre, a family of Tinderkin, and a human."
"A human?"
said Poldo.
"Oh, yes. Aubryn is a young girl. She fled Perald when Vetchel fell. I found her wandering the streets a couple of days ago, poor dear. She's helping out around the house and watching the pups while I work."
Poldo nodded.
"Fair enough. But is there room for her to sleep? For any of them?"
"We've shifted some furniture around, and Grazgub Bloodroar has put together 3 sets of bunks so far."
Mrs. Herc dropped a sugar cube into her tea and then put one in Poldo's.
"Did I mention that Mr. Bloodroar has a knack for carpentry?" "No? Well, as it turns out, he does. Anyway, we can probably take in another 3 or 4 before the bunk rooms are complete. 6 if they're goblins or kobolds."
"And when will the bunk rooms be done?" asked Poldo.
"Not until we get the permits. They can't come soon enough."
Mrs. Herc sighed and looked out the window.
"We expect more refugees from Perald and Vetchel soon."
Poldo nodded and watched the knoll. Mrs. Herc's mange had cleared up in recent weeks, and now her coat had an orange hue to it. Coupled with her fox-like features and her large ears, she looked like she was at least part Fennekin, though Poldo wouldn't dream of asking her. It was usually considered rude to inquire which clan a gnome belonged to, and he assumed that asking gnolls if they had demi-gnoll heritage violated similar social mores. Mrs. Herc glanced back at him, and he quickly looked out the window and cleared his throat. Trade sprites were darting through the air, bright spots of crimson and emerald against the dark and brooding sky.
"Well, let me know if you need help getting the permits," Poldo said. "In the meantime, we'll do what we can. There will always be more people to help."
Mrs. Herc smiled at him.
"You're a good man, Mr. Poldo."
The Scribkin chuckled without humor and looked to the sprites fluttering across the skyline.
"I mean it."
Poldo shook his head.
"Mrs. Herc, do you know how much gold I made because Vetchel fell? And how much more I took in from investors speculating about the sacking of Perald?
Everything I give those refugees is a cut of the profits I made off their misery. Mr. Poldo and the Shadowkin, I've done far worse to all of you.
Poldo stared at the window, but he saw old quests swimming before his eyes, every one of them a death warrant for some monster or Shadowkin.
I made my fortune plying in loot taken from your people, and now they're my tenants. I try to be social in the hallways, but I can't even look them in the eye.
You give them a place to stay, Mr. Poldo. You give them hope in a dark time,
Mrs. Hurt countered.
They only need what I gave them because of how much I took from them, said Poldo wearily. I wonder if I can ever lift them up to the heights I pushed them from.
He started as Mrs. Herc placed a paw on his hand, leaning over the table.
Mr. Poldo, I believe you are a good man, she said with an air of finality.
Poldo knew that people only prefixed a statement with, I believe, when there wasn't sufficient evidence to prove it, but he also knew when Mrs. Herc would brook no argument. He managed a small smile. A tiny bell rang, signaling that Poldo's next meeting was set to begin. Mrs. Herc took the tea set and left Poldo with his thoughts. He took a moment to collect them, then carried his mug of tea over to his desk. A pack of wood gnomes led by Red Squirrel waited on his blotter next to a small silver bell. Several more were already hard at work, rapidly transcribing a message onto a sheet of paper on Poldo's desk. They used a set of tiny rubber stamps that Poldo commissioned expressly for that purpose, each with a single letter or number and a grip sized for a domovoy's hands. Working in concert, the wood gnomes could create a reasonably legible document almost as soon as it was dictated.
"Is it time for the afternoon report?"
asked Poldo, sipping his tea. Then he read the message and promptly sprayed the beverage over his desk.
"Lich Datar Ermion defeats Bannerman at Highwatch. King Handor slain. World's top heroes undead. Hertzwood rumored sacked by Red Horde or other Shadowkin."
By the gods! Poldo stumbled as he fell into his chair, suddenly dizzy. Red Squirrel nodded gravely as he wrung out a corner of his pelt. The wood gnomes kept stamping out their report.
Heroes Guild raises threat index across Arth. Threat index for Hertzwood up by over 2,000%. Threat index for Aberyth and surrounding regions up by 347%.
A deep chill ran up Poldo's spine.
The threat obligations. New Age's total threat obligations payouts exceed estimated cash on hand by over 10 billion gilton. Dalen Elven Assemblage's total payouts exceed estimated cash on hand by over 3 billion gilton. Lamia Sister's total payouts exceed estimated cash on hand by 19 billion gilton.
They can't pay all of their threat obligations, said Poldo weakly.
Figures and amounts swam before his mind's eye, a grim litany of financial ruin. If banks missed payments to the holders of their threat obligations, then the holders of the obligations would stop paying for the obligations they held, and the banks would have less cash to pay their obligations. It was more than a vicious cycle. It was the quick, terminal spiral of an ant caught in a drain, and it could drag the whole market down with it.
Sell! Sell! Sell!
Poldo stumbled over the word as he scrambled for his summoning stone. The gnomes on his desk scattered, quickly fetching his ledger and various reports. Immediately he issued orders to sell the rest of any CTOs he still held. Then he dumped all of his shares in the major banks. A line of scarlet sprites bobbed across his office as fast as he could summon them, casting the room in ruby light. Yet at some point after he had issued a sale order for Goldson bags, he noticed that the red hue was also pouring in through his windows. The wood gnomes crowded on the sill of the largest pane, staring out with upturned faces. Poldo stood and approached the window with a sinking feeling in his stomach. The sky was painted blood red by a multitude of crimson sprites swarming through the air toward the Andoran Stock Exchange. Every single one was a stock for sale, a company abandoned, another dip in prices that were already tumbling. They drifted along errant paths up the mountain like embers in the wind.